Hi, it's Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. Our program is produced by Minnesota Public Radio and brought to you by Super Target. Today we talk Christmas dinner and life with a domestic goddess, the one and only Nigella Lawson. She's the British food star who's turned the TV cooking show on its ear. Wine maverick Joshua Wesson waxes eloquent on the art of the toast. Reporter Scott Haas tells us how a kid from the Boston Projects became the star chef of Beacon Hill. Francis Ford Coppola, a man who'd almost rather cook and eat than make films, shares his Christmas at the Vineyard. And as always, in the second half of the show, we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. So let's kick off the show with Jane and Michael Stern. They write the Road Food column in Gourmet magazine. Hey, Jane, Michael, any great place that you guys like to go for the holidays?
Yeah, a very unlikely one. It's in Greenwood, Indiana, and it's called Jonathan Bird's Cafeteria.
That's B-Y-R-D. And, you know, just before we even get to the holiday stuff at Jonathan Bird's, we should say that Indiana is really a hotbed of great, great cafeteria dining. It always has been. I don't know why, but in and around Indianapolis, you find really grand and glorious cafeterias.
Like the old Horn and Hard Art.
Jonathan Bird's is gigantic. In fact, it boasts that it is America's largest cafeteria with an 88-foot-long serving line and a minimum of 20 entrees any day.
And, you know, there's something about cafeterias. I've never quite figured it out. But it's like if you go into Tiffany or Cartier, like the jewelry is under some sort of special lighting where everything, like, twinkles and looks better than it does when you get it out of the store. And it's the same in Jonathan Bird's cafeteria. I mean, you put a plate of red jello under the lights there, and it looks like,
it looks like something from Cartier.
It looks like, right, a ruby from Cartier.
It's the amber and baby pink spots that they use.
Is that what it is?
Yeah. So what does this place look like?
Well, it is huge, and yet there's something very cozy and comfortable about it. It's decorated like you would wish your grandmother's house was decorated. I mean, very comfortable, kind of mid-American, Victorian, comfortable seats, big, broad tables with lots of elbow room. And, of course, it's like a gigantic family reunion when you eat there every day of the year.
In fact, if you wonder why your grandmother isn't at the stove cooking, you will find her at Jonathan Bird's cafeteria. There are a lot of what they used to call blue-haired old ladies, but they know where the good food is.
So more about the food. I mean, when you talked about food in Indiana, what else is on that line?
Well, it's real home cooking. I mean, one of the things you always want to eat in Indiana is fried chicken with real pan gravy, real mashed potatoes, nice chunky mashed potatoes, and lots of side dishes. I mean, greens, beans, turnip greens, wonderful macaroni and cheese here. I mean, the kind that, I don't know, I can't make it at home, but the kind with just enough kind of crusty stuff from the outside and top of the casserole and lots of creamy stuff from down inside. Every serving is like that.
Jonathan Bird's is also a place where you go to hear gospel music, and they have gospel music all year round. But around the holidays, they really do this big special gospel fest where people from Ohio and all the neighboring states come to listen.
Well, on New Year's Eve they do. They have a special jubilation gospel sing on New Year's Eve. This New Year's Eve, they have the Collingsworth family, the Golden Covenant, and Gospel Brass. Those are three groups that are going to be performing. You pay $25 per person. You eat yourself silly at the buffet line, and then you listen to music until midnight when there's a candlelight service. Now, we should say, no liquor is served, no liquor is ever served at Jonathan Bird's cafeteria, because Jonathan Bird, who started it, doesn't believe in liquor.
It doesn't sound like you need it with all that great food and all that great music.
No, and don't forget to end your meal with bread pudding laced with slices of apples and caramel sauce. It is just delicious. And like all good cafeterias, the desserts are put first, so you choose your dessert before you choose your meal, which makes perfect sense to me.
Makes sense to me, too. We'll see you there on New Year's Eve, guys.
All right, Lynn.
Happy holidays.
See
you, Lynn. Bye.
Jesus is coming on me. shall go
on. Shane and Michael Stern have updated their classic guidebook, Road Food. Now, every week you can hear them here on the Splendid Table, but you can get their road food finds anytime. Just go to the website, splendidtable.org. And by the way, take a look at our new weekly newsletter. It's called Weeknight Kitchen, and it's all about easy dishes for work nights. There's a new recipe every week, my notes on key techniques, and ideas for what to look for in the market right now. You can register for it on the site, and guys, it's free. I have some last-minute gift ideas. We had a party last weekend, and the biggest hit of the party was a chunk of sharp cheddar that I set out with a bowl of candied orange peel. And it struck me this would make a great gift bag. You take about a pound of sharp cheddar and then candied orange rind. I had found this candied orange rind in syrup in a Middle Eastern market. I think it's made in Greece. And I had just opened up a jar and put it in a bowl. If you don't get to the Middle Eastern market, you could use, you know, stuff from a candy store. So put it in a gift bag and you have a gift. Now, the other thing to think about is brandied vanilla fruits. This is a case where you put the fruits, dried fruits, in a bowl, cover them with brandy, let them stand for a couple of hours, then drain off the brandy, combine it with sugar, vanilla, and a bit of water, and boil it to a syrup. Pack those fruits into glass jars, fill the jars about a quarter full with that syrup, top everything off with brandy, seal it up, and you have a gift. Now, you could use apricots. You could use dried pears. I put together apricots and prunes in one jar. They look really pretty. And, of course, you put this over ice cream, over fruit, or just pop the fruit in your mouth. It tastes great. Another idea, how about an instant spread? Take your favorite hot salsa, fold it into, you know, sour cream cheese, chopped onion. Just pack that into a nice-looking bowl. Add a box of good crackers, and maybe even a pretty little kitchen towel. Put that all in a bag, and you've got another Christmas gift. We're going to put all of these ideas up on the website, you know, splendidtable.org. Joshua Wesson is a wine expert who follows his own drummer. He believes good wine can be had for little money, and he's always coming up with new ideas of what to try. Hey, Josh, good to talk to you again.
It's always good to talk to you.
You know, I bet you're a man who has some dynamite toasts for the holiday season.
I have to. It's my job. You know, I get people who call me and say, give me a toast, so I keep probably 10 or 20 literally in my bag at all times, so I could pull them out. They don't care about wine recommendations. They just want to use me for, you know, my alleged wit. But most of these toasts, of course, are old, and they came from other places, so I don't claim any responsibility. But, you know, it's easy to toast. You just got to sort of figure out what the tone should be. Do you want your audience to laugh, or should they be wiping away tears? And you got to think about who you're speaking to. And it's always good to personalize it a little bit. And look people in the eye. Eye contact is critical when you're toasting. I hate people who toast but don't look at the folks they're toasting. And if you're toasting just one person, you've got to look at them in the eye or you'll have bad luck forever. It's really, you know, one of those things.
So what are some favorites?
Here are a couple of New Year's Eve toasts because we're coming up to the holidays. This one always makes people chuckle. As you slide down the banister of life, may the splinters never point the wrong way. May we have more and more friends and need them less and less.
Oh, that's lovely. I like that.
And this is one, you know, for a short, for the weepy-eyed New Year's Eve toast, which everyone will smile and hug and kiss. May good fortune precede you, love walk with you, and good friends follow you. You know, maudlin or... magnificent.
Well,
you make the call.
Exactly. So what do you think makes a good toast?
I think that it's a mixture of empathy and honesty And it's as much in the delivery as it is in the words, because good words can't save a bad delivery, but a really good delivery can take bad words and imbue them with some passion and dignity and meaning. But it really depends on who you're talking to, and if you want everyone to sort of sigh and hug, you can use one of those, you know, more mid-brow toasts. And if you want people to smile, then find something with a bit of humor, like, may you live all the days of your life.
You know, I really think, especially this year, I want some giggles. Any thoughts?
Okay. Here's to great friends. They know you well and like you just the same.
I like that.
And it's always good to have a toast to lovers, whether it's an anniversary or a wedding or just, you know, around people who are very happy. May we kiss whom we please. And please whom we kiss, but love only those whose lips we would miss.
Oh, I like that. How about toasts to, you know, our parents, the older folks in the family? Anything that fits in that category to sort of honor them?
Sure. May the best day of your past be the worst day of your future.
Okay.
May you always work like you don't need the money. Which could be a toast on its own, but you could throw in, you know, a gift with purchase of the second line. Love like you've never been hurt, or my favorite, because I'm not a good dancer, and dance like there's nobody watching.
I think that's my all-time favorite. That's really a great toast.
We should dance together sometime.
Oh, boy. I don't even want to think about that. Hey, happy holidays, Josh.
Here's looking at you, kid.
Joshua Wesson is president of Bestsellers Wine Shops. Coming up, Christmas dinner with Nigella Lawson, Chef Barbara Lynch's journey from the Boston Projects to star chef status, and open lines for your calls. Reach us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table, produced by Minnesota Public Radio and distributed by PRI. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show about life's appetites. The Splendid Table is brought to you by SuperTarget, a grocery store and Target store all in one. In addition to a complete Target store, SuperTarget features a bakery, deli, fresh produce, meats, and seafood. To find the SuperTarget nearest you, you can visit them online at Target.com. England's Nigella Lawson brings a new take to the TV food show. She's smart, practical, gorgeous, sexy. She makes no claim at being an expert, and as a result, she's a culinary superstar. What I like about Nigella is this. She swiped the culinary crown from the chefs and placed it back where it probably belongs, at home, on the head of a woman who cooks for herself, her kids, and her friends. Nigella's show, Nigella Bites, appears on the Style Network. She writes for the New York Times, and her cookbooks include How to Be a Domestic Goddess and Nigella Bites. Nigella Lawson, welcome.
Oh, thank you. What a lovely welcome it is, too. Thanks a lot.
Well, how are the states treating you?
Oh, I love it here. I mean, what I find particularly is that when I get to the states is that people are always very relieved to meet such a mess. And I'm not even insulted when they say that. But just simply that, you know, as you were saying, cooking is about what happens at home. It's not really what happens in restaurants. Fabulous though that is. And, you know, I love the food that the great chefs make. But I think it's so important to remember that cooking is just what happens in people's homes. And I think other people too are relieved because they see, you know, I chop a carrot, I spill some on the ground, you know, I'm pouring some milk into a jug, some of it splashes on the counter. And so I'm not insulted by the notion of mess, because actually when we're cooking in real lives, we don't have that much time to put on a performance or to get everything right. What you're trying to do is get supper on the table. And that's, people, everyone appreciates that, I think.
Mm-hmm. Well, now you shoot the show actually in your home. What does that do to your family life?
Well, I don't live there now, I have to say. I think my children are now 6 and 8 and have got to an age when they rebel too much. In fact, it suited my family life very well. I certainly, when I started doing the show, I had a husband who was very sick and there was no way I'd have gone out of the house in the daytime. And I also, my children were young, so I could get them off to school or nursery and then I could work knowing that I wasn't far away and therefore I didn't need to panic. And so it all kind of dovetailed very well. Now I think I'm beginning to try and separate home and work more. So I'm trying to sort of reclaim the notion of there's a private life and there's a working life. But in a sense, what I do goes against that, because when I talk about food, I am talking about life, and I can only ever talk honestly and from the heart. And I believe in being very open and very straightforward. And I think if you write about food or if you're cooking on television, in a sense, it is an intimate act, and that remains. And I wouldn't want that to be taken away.
Well, you know, right now, living in this season, this holiday season, is about a lot of entertaining. What do you think makes a good party?
It's so important, I feel, so crucial not to go overboard with really cooking things which are going to make you stressed. Because there is nothing worse than not being able to enjoy the company of your friends and the whole holiday spirit because you've given yourself 22 different things to do 5 minutes ago. So I also think that I have a kind of rule, which is it's always better to have a huge amount of a very few things rather than lots and lots of things, but only in small quantities, because I always feel abundance is what feels welcoming. So, for example, if I want to have cheese at a party, I'd rather have just 2 or 3 different cheeses, but incredibly big hunks of those cheeses, because if you have lots of little slices, then no one ever dares take a bit, because you take a slice and you've taken everyone else's cheese. I think you want to feel everyone can have second, third helpings, and there'll still be more. And somehow, I love that rather old-fashioned idea, which sort of feels appropriate at this time of year, of the, you know, the groaning boards. You know, those old paintings with these thick, heavy wooden tables and a huge hunk of meat and a huge wodge of cheese and, you know, thick cloth. And you sort of feel, I want to be in that painting.
Well, what is Christmas like at your house? What are the traditions for you and your children?
Well, we have very few traditions, but those traditions we have are immutable. So I'm not very good with my hands. I can't do any sort of craft or anything like that. But one thing I do with my children is we make the edible Christmas tree decorations. And so I make this sort of rather heavily, I'm a mean mother, you know. I really spice them, because if I make them too nice to eat, then the minute they're up on the tree, they take them down. So I add a bit of black pepper to the cookie mix, so that they just, you know, maybe pick off a bit of the icing. So we make them together, like some is shaped of stars, some of angels, some of bells. They're very basic kind of Christmas shapes. And we decorate them. And I go, you know, I try for chic, you know, a little bit of white icing, maybe a silver bauble. You know, my children both, you know, I think they're the sort of implicit style guru is Donatella Versace. Any color goes on. The more baubles, the better. I mean, they look gaudy. But, you know, minimalism is not kind of, it's not an aesthetic allure for children. So we have this very oddly decorated tree with many different art styles going on it. And in just in case I'm creating this picture of, you know, lovingness by the stove, you know, the amount of rows that go on while we're doing this is just, you can't believe, because my children always in the end start putting their faces straight into the bowl of frosting. Anyway, Christmas wouldn't be Christmas without a family row, would it?
No, I don't think so. No.
You were going to leave us with an entertaining menu, and I'd like to talk to you a little bit about it. We've got this slow roast shoulder of pork that stays in the oven for almost 20 hours and it just melts in your mouth. But there's something you have on the menu that I'd like you to tell us about specifically. It's Liptauer cheese as an hors d'oeuvre. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Oh, I certainly can. Now, no one really knows what Liptauer is, and I don't blame them because you never really find it now. When I was a child, I remember so well going with my mother to delis, and I can remember because my eyes must have been just where the counter started, you know, quite low down, and there'd be this mound of creamy white cheese flecked with green and brown and kind of like rivulets of orange running over it. And we used to eat this at home a lot, and I've since found out it is really an Eastern European speciality, which is a mixture of cream cheese and cottage cheese. You just mix that with capers and teeny little gherkins and a bit of paprika, some caraway seeds, a bit of French mustard. You mix that together and you can mold it in a kind of tub-shaped bowl. You can do anything with it. And then what you do later is make a little runny paste just of paprika and some very low-flavoured flavours, groundnut oil, something like that, and you just drizzle that over. And the mixture of that cream cheese with the spices and the mustard, and I love it on pumpernickel or black bread or bagels, anything. And it's one of those things that people always look like you're a bit mad when you first suggest it, but you cannot have just one bit of it. You find that if you make it at a party, no one moves from where it is. They're just hovering so they can keep putting their knife back in.
You have this lovely ending to the menu, the bitter orange ice cream.
Well, I love, you know, I like anything with the word bitter in it. You know, I feel it's very, very, I like it when everyone's feeling so warm-spirited, just to add this note. Now, the bitter oranges in question are really Seville oranges, which don't really come into the stores till January, if at all. But you can approximate Seville, a bitter orange, very, very easily by mixing ordinary sweet eating orange with a bit of lime. And you get then the intensity of the deepest orange flavour without it being sweet. It's, I don't know, I can't, it really sets it off well. And the reason I do this ice cream a lot is because you don't need a churn, you don't need an ice cream maker. You're just mixing, frankly, the zests, the juice, some cream, some sugar. You just put it in a container, you put it in the freezer. So it can't be any easier than that, frankly.
Sounds perfect to me. Nigella Lawson, thank you so much and happy holidays.
Well, same to you. Thank you.
Nigella Lawson is author of Nigella Bites. Her TV show of the same name is seen on the Style Network. Nigella left us with a little holiday menu. Liptauer cheese, slow roasted aromatic pork shoulder, and that bitter orange ice cream. You can find all the recipes and a lot more holiday ideas on the website, splendidtable.org. Our ever-hungry reporter, Scott Haas, checks in with us from all over the world. But today he brings us a story of perseverance, family roots, and food from his own backyard. Boston.
I'm standing in the middle of the Mary Ellen McCormick housing projects in South Boston. It's one of the poorest and most interesting parts of Boston and the entire Eastern Seaboard. During the 1970s, this was an area where the racial unrest and the difficulties associated with enforced busing took place. It's a poor area, it's a tough area, but it's also an area that has enormous pride in itself. And I'm here with Barbara Lynch, the chef owner of Number 9 Park, one of the city's poshest restaurants. Barbara grew up in these housing projects. I'm here to find out, what was it like to grow up in a housing project? What influence did it have on her later life as a successful chef and owner of one of the city's top restaurants? And then afterward, we're going to go back to the restaurant and cook some dishes for Christmas, maybe inspired by her having grown up here. Hey, Barbara.
Hi, Scott.
How you doing? Thanks for joining me. So where are we standing, Barbara?
Well, we're standing on Logan Way, right in front of 51 Logan Way, where I grew up with seven brothers and sisters and a single mom. Pretty big Irish, Catholic little project.
So describe it to me. I mean,
growing up in a normal house and having neighbors, a majority of us all grew up with a single parent, and it would be very strange if you had two parents with you. Eventually, and as years went on, it became affordable housing, Section 8 housing, and then, of course, 70s after the busing, when integration played a part, a lot of the blacks moved out. And this became white, and then 10 years after that, it's now Hispanic and Chinese. And
you mean there were African-American families along with white families here?
Yes.
And they moved out because?
Racial wars. There was a lot of racial wars in the projects. You know, black families that decided to stay here had to have 24-hour security. So it was a lot of, like, 2 years of just, you know, pure hell. They were living in, you know, they couldn't leave or walk to go to the grocery store or do their errands. And
that was the time you grew up here?
Yeah. Totally, right through the full force busing era.
So what was it about your upbringing? I'm of the opinion that people succeed in later life, not in spite of how they're brought up, but because of it. So what was it? Was there an experience growing up that led to your success now?
I have to say the one experience I think led to all of this was that I worked at this private club on Commonwealth Avenue called the St. Patolph Club, and we had done a lot of Lescoffier dinners, and my mother worked there, and a lot of the women who lived in this project worked there, and pretty much I was serving sweetbreads under a bell. Everything was with white gloves on, so that's, I figured it out around 12. I knew I wanted to be a chef. I had no idea I would get to the point where I'm at, except for, I think, also growing up in a city environment like this with seven brothers and sisters and a single mom, you're taught really young at an early age to work, respect others, you know, have great morals, and just pray to say a prayer to God that you do the right thing. As my mom had always said, I don't know what it is with you. You have champagne taste on a welfare budget.
Well, I have an idea, Barbara. Can we go to your restaurant now and you can prepare some things for Christmas?
Yes, let's go prepare some chestnut bisque and maybe stuff a capon.
That sounds great. Now, was that the kind of thing you had growing up?
No, absolutely not.
What would you have for Christmas growing up?
For Christmas, actually, we would have Chinese food on Christmas Eve.
No.
Yeah.
That sounds good.
Yeah, exactly. And then during the day, everybody else, I'd make some like lasagnas and eggplant parmesan.
But not chestnut bisque and roast capon.
No.
Chestnuts roasting on an open fire. Jack Frost nipping at your nose.
All right, so Barbara, what are you doing here?
We're going to chop some onion, celery, and carrot and saute it with a little bacon for the chestnut bisque.
Okay.
Basically, you want to sweat out your onion, celery, carrots, bacon in just about 10 minutes, and then you want to add some parsnips and some chestnuts, and then you're going to deglaze your pan with about a half a bottle of port wine and maybe a cup of red wine and reduce that down, and you're going to add a little bit of water or chicken stock. Then cook that for about 25 minutes until your chestnuts are soft and you want to then puree it.
How would you puree it?
In a blender. Add a little heavy cream to it or a little half and half. Just because when you puree it, the color is very gray. And if you add a little cream, it makes it a little bit silkier and the color is a much more attractive color.
You make it sound very easy.
It is really easy. It's very easy.
So what's the lesson here, Barbara? Is you grew up in a neighborhood that a lot of people, frankly, and not to be maudlin about it, but a lot of people didn't get out of that neighborhood. So what's the story? You have to stay focused? Do you have a goal? I mean, do you have a lesson for people?
I'm assuming I was focused. I mean, I think that when I'm on a mission, I'm on a mission. It was one of those things where I said, as growing up and working in restaurants, I'm going to have my own restaurant. I'm going to have my own restaurant. I'm going to have my own restaurant. So that I said it so many times that it had to happen. And as luck had it, it happened to me. I dreamt about it. I knew what I wanted. I knew what not to do. I knew the location I wanted, which is in Beacon Hill. It's something that I...
You knew as a kid you wanted a restaurant in this neighborhood?
Well, after working at the St. Patolph Club, I knew where I wanted to be. I knew where the affluential people would be. I know exactly, you know, they're world travelers. I know what they want to eat. And I said, if I'm going to settle for this business and I'm going to be in it, I'm going to have to be the best I can be.
So now that's a dead pheasant. So you're going to roast this pheasant, are you?
Let's just stuff it and slow roast this about at 250 or 275.
Wow, that is slow. How long would you roast it for then?
I'd like to try it. Let's do it for about an hour and a half.
Okay.
2 hours.
Uh-huh.
And we'll baste it with a little butter. I'm going to stick a little butter underneath the skin.
So Barbara, do you find this therapeutic?
You
look so much calmer inside the kitchen than you do elsewhere.
I feel very comfortable in the kitchen.
You were not professionally trained. What's your education, I mean?
My education is work hard, be a team player, listen to others.
But I mean your actual education.
Oh, I actually, high school, and I really never graduated high school.
You didn't finish high school. Wow. Well, does that embarrass you for me to ask you that? Or?
No, I just find it humorous, I guess.
That's amazing.
I know. I tried my GED. I'm more of a visualist. I can't sit down in a classroom. I need to be on dance.
It certainly tells you something. I mean, you're running one of the city's top restaurants. You've got about 18 staff here, plus the front of the house.
And it's amazing that our food cost is in line and our liquor cost is in line. And we're actually making some money, you know?
Well, I wanted to thank you for taking the time to meet with me today. The bisque looks beautiful, and I hope you have a Merry Christmas.
Thanks, Scott. You too. I hope you try to cook this stuff.
Merry Christmas to you.
Scott Haas is a writer who lives in Boston. Barbara Lynch is chef owner of Number 9 Park Restaurant. She was honored last year by the South Boston Neighborhood House for her contributions to the community. Well, it's time for our weekly trivia question. Now, here's the query. Since this is the season when port wine is most popular, I challenge you to tell me what port has to do with bad luck. Now, we're going to have that answer in a moment, and we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table, produced by Minnesota Public Radio and distributed by Public Radio International. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. The Splendid Table is brought to you by Super Target, a full-service grocery store and Target together in one stop. Super Target has a variety of ingredients and imported spices for those holiday recipes you want to try. You can visit them online at Target.com to find a store near you. Now, we're going to be opening the lines for your calls in a moment. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. But first, I've got the answer to this week's trivia challenge. Now, the question was, now, since this is the season when port wine is most popular, can you tell me what port has to do with bad luck? Well, the secret is how you pass the port around the table. You have to always pass it to the right. If you pass port to the left, it's going to bring bad luck to everybody who's seated there. Now, this means if you turn down a glass and then you change your mind, that decanter has to go all the way around the table before it comes back to you. Now, all of this information is from the proverbial horse's mouth, specifically from a British butler named Stanley Ager. Now, years ago, he did this book called The Butler's Guide. Stanley has all kinds of port information. For instance, never take an after-dinner cigar until the port has finished
and the toast to the Queen is completed. In Stanley's day, ladies never drank port except as a mid-morning pick-me-up along with a dry biscuit. The port decanter should never be open in the presence of cigarette smoke because it absorbs the smell, and it should always be placed at the right hand of the host. Well, this host likes her holiday port with dried pears and blue cheese. Oh, and one other thing from the butler. Never allow the servants to take fine port on your shooting lunches. It doesn't travel well. We are opening the lines for your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. Okay, let's get right to the phones. We've got Wendy calling. Hey, Wendy, what do you want to talk about?
Well, actually, I have been trying to make a really good quiche for a while. I found a quiche recipe, really nice and basic. I made it, took it out, let it sit the 10 minutes that it says, you know, let it set. Cut into it, it was watery.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know what? I got the problem.
Okay.
I got the problem.
Great.
Solved, I think. It may be the temperature of your oven.
Okay.
Because what you're making when you make a quiche, no matter what's in it, if it's got sugar and some kind of liquid, you're making a custard.
Okay.
And if you cook a custard at too high a heat, I can't tell you what happens scientifically, but this is what I think. The egg molecules shrink and they let water escape. That's what goes on in my head. Generally, you cook quiche at about 350.
Okay.
But most of our ovens are off. And you want to cook anything with eggs in it a little bit on the slow side. I would do 350, but I'd stick an oven thermometer in your oven just to be on the safe side.
Okay.
Because I used to have an oven that had, it read 350 evenly, and if you turned it up, it went immediately to 425. There was nothing in between. So check your oven temperature. Try this, whatever recipe you like, at 350 and see what happens.
Okay.
And by the way, the key with a custard is you cook it until you insert a knife near the center, and it comes out pretty clean. But the center might be a tad creamy yet. And as it cools down, it will finish cooking.
Okay.
And it'll be as smooth as silk.
Wonderful. See, I always go places. I have the best quiche, and I say, I wish I could make it at home, and it never works.
You can do this, woman.
Thanks.
Many thanks.
Bye.
You can reach us at 800-537-5252. Okay, let's see. Who's up next? We've got Dinesha calling. Dinesha, what's up?
Hi there. I'm calling from Raleigh, North Carolina, and I'm a recent newlywed, and I'm afraid I've got myself in quite a pickle.
And what did you do?
At the wedding in July, I told both families that my new husband and I were going to spend Christmas at our house this year. Well, then the whole family, both families, invited themselves to our house. Now, the problem is my family is vegetarian, and my husband's family is definitely not vegetarian, and I have never cooked Christmas dinner ever before and don't know what to do.
Have they gotten the idea, you know, maybe newlyweds want to be alone on the first Christmas?
Well, that was sort of the idea, but my family's all about holidays, and so now I'm stuck cooking for everyone.
Okay.
Everyone said they'd pitch in, but of course it's at my house, so I feel like I need to do the bulk of the work.
All right, how many people?
We're talking maybe 10 to 15.
Okay, here's the deal. My favorite fallback position for people who don't eat meat, and even the vegans, you know, who eat no animal products.
Right.
You're going to take a mess of vegetables. You're going to take sweet peppers. You're going to take cut up carrots. Potatoes, wedges of onion,
okay?
You can throw in some turnips, you can throw in cauliflower. You're gonna cut all of those things up into pieces that are maybe an inch or 2 inches big. Throw them into a big bowl, or even into a garbage sack if it's too big, you know, if you don't have a bowl big enough. You're gonna add some olive oil, salt, pepper, okay?
That sounds great.
All right. Fresh basil. And any other seasoning you like. Like, for instance, I always throw in some Indian spice.
Oh.
like garam masala, but something you think you'd enjoy. You're going to toss that together. All right. Mm-hmm. You're going to have a bunch of big, shallow pans. They can even be those aluminum pans, you know, those aluminum foil pans that you buy in the grocery store. And what you're going to do is you're going to have your oven at about 400 degrees. And you may have to do this. You can do this by the way, 2-3 days ahead.
Okay.
So what you want to do is get those vegetables spread in the pan so that they're not crowded too much and you want to roast them. So you may have to do this in a few batches.
Okay, sure.
All right. Now, when you're all done with that, it's going to take about an hour. When you stick them with a fork or a knife and they're tender, you know they're done. And then I'd mix some chickpeas in with that.
Oh, wow.
Right. And then what I'd do is I'd get somebody to make saffron or turmeric rice, golden rice.
Okay. Big mouth. Indian flavoring.
Yeah, exactly. And then what I'd do is I would put those gorgeous vegetables on top of that golden rice and
you have
a main dish.
Wonderful.
So you're done there. And then I would have somebody who's a meat eater come over to the house and roast the turkey on Christmas Day with you. One of the members of his family that really loves to eat meat, because they're going to do it brilliantly. Never cook anything that you really hate, because you're not going to do a good job with it.
Right.
Now, for the rest of the menu, I think you could do something like sweet potatoes, however you like them.
Right. Okay.
All right. A big green salad.
Sure.
Okay. Have the turkey. Have the cranberry sauce. Have somebody bring 2 or 3 desserts, and I think you are just about home free.
I think that sounds wonderful.
Okay.
Thank you so much.
You are welcome. Have a great first Christmas with your husband.
Thanks a lot.
Leave the kids alone on Christmas, for goodness sakes. Okay, you can reach us, 800-537-5252. Let's see, who's up next? Alicia is calling. What do you want to talk about?
Well, I wanted to talk about icing. During the holiday season when I was growing up, my mother would make these cakes. And she's from England, so I think it stems from her upbringing.
Yeah.
But she would make a cake and then put marzipan over it.
Yeah.
And then with icing, she would make a church out of the icing.
Like a three-dimensional church?
Yeah. So it was like a little miniature sculpture of a church. And my question is, I've been looking on recipes on how to make icing, but I haven't found a consistency that can sort of make a house out of icing.
Make a house out of icing. There's royal icing, you know, that is egg whites and sugar, and it's called royal icing or royal frosting, and it's used on wedding cakes and that kind of thing, especially in England. You can pipe it, and it gets pretty crisp. So that may be one thing to look up.
Okay.
And the other thing is, I'm wondering, because I know exactly, I can picture this in my mind's eye, and that's a very traditional British Christmas cake.
Uh-huh.
I'm just thinking if there are any British sites that you might be able to get a recipe for this.
Uh-huh.
You know, there's the old cookbook. It's from the 1890s, but it has everything in it. Mrs. Beaton's cookbook.
Okay.
And it's B-E-E-T-O-N apostrophe S. And I think if you type Mrs. Beaton in quotes on google.com, you're going to find it.
Okay.
Also,
great.
British Christmas cake.
Okay.
You're going to find it. I'm sorry I don't have the you know, a real answer for you, but I think that's where the hunting should go.
Okay, I'll go in that direction.
Okay, and thank you.
Thank you so much.
Take care.
Bye.
Goodbye. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. Two books to check out for great last-minute food gifts. Easy to do things, small quantities. One is The Glass Pantry by Georgianne Brennan, and the other one is Quick Pickles by Chris Slazinger and John Willoughby. And I think you're going to find both those titles on the website. So, last-minute food gifts. We've solved your problem. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. Let's get back to the phones. We've got Lorraine on the line. So, Lorraine, what's up?
Hi, Lynn. I was calling because I have a wild turkey to prepare, and I was hoping that you might have some suggestions. It's a bird that I actually hunted and got, and we don't pluck them, we skin them.
Oh, I see. Okay, so there's no skin on the bird at this point.
Right. And that presents a little bit of difficulty. I've made a couple before, and it's always tricky trying to calculate the time.
Yeah.
And also to come up with some different methods on trying to keep them moist, because it's a drier meat than a domestic bird to begin with.
Yeah, yeah. And it's also usually a pretty muscular meat because the animal's been out there flapping and working hard.
Yeah. The wings are pretty much for stewing, and the legs are very much tougher, so they're almost for stewing or braising, too.
Yeah. You know, one of the things you can do, it's an old French trick. It is called larding. And what you would do is you could take salt pork, you could take butter, some form of fat, okay, that's flavorful, and you mix it with herbs that you think you would like or flavoring that you'd like, and you make holes with it with a paring knife into the meat of the bird, into the breast meat, and you insert the fat. So essentially what you're doing is you're adding marbling. And this used to be used constantly with game meat because it would moisten it from the inside out as it roasted. The other thing is that what you want to do also, that's called larding. And if you put fat over something, it's barding. And I think if you use a mild bacon or a pancetta, especially over the breast area as you roast it, and then I'd baste it with wine, with some red wine. So lard it the night before to let the flavors permeate. You could have a little garlic and shallot and perhaps, you know, some green herb like a bit of thyme or rosemary. And then the next day, lay some strips of fat over the bird, put it in a 325-degree oven, and roast it slow and baste it occasionally with red wine, and then start basting it with the pan juices, which is essentially what you would do with a regular turkey. But in this case, you're adding the fat that will keep the meat moist and flavorful.
Right. Okay, sounds great.
But remember the larding. It's a great trick when you're dealing with very lean game.
We eat a lot of deer meat, too, so we would probably benefit by using that on some of it.
It's a great way to do venison. Have a good holiday.
Oh, well, you too, Lynn.
You take care.
Bye-bye.
Goodbye. I love this idea that there are these two terms, barding and larding, and it's the kind of thing that when you're dealing with food snobs, it usually stops them in their tracks. Just remember, barding is when you put fat on the outside, and larding is when you put it on the inside, in the meat. Under the category of all you can do is just shake your head, I was in St. Louis recently, and I was having dinner by myself. I looked across the room, and there were four people seated at a table, and through the entire meal, all four were on their cell phones. It just made you wonder why they decided to sit together. Well, you know, in this time of holiday feasting, I think it's appropriate to check in with one of the world's great hosts, Francis Ford Coppola. Oh, yeah, I know he makes movies, but he also sets a mean table. Thanks for being with us, Mr. Coppola.
Thank you very much.
So where are you going to be this Christmas? Are you going to be at the Vineyard?
Yes, we're going to be here in Rutherford in the Napa Valley at the Nebom Coppola Estate, where we live and have lived for the last at least 25 years.
How many people are going to be at the table?
Well, we're not exactly sure because the Coppolas are very mercurial and you never know who's going to show up. But I think for sure it will be the four of the family and a spouse and a girlfriend, so I guess we'll be certainly no less than six or seven and a granddaughter. And then also there will maybe my sister Tally and her three sons will come, so we're trying to calculate.
And you never know what's going to happen.
We never know.
Well, now, you love to cook, from what I understand.
Well, that originally came from the fact that I love to eat.
So what are you going to be doing for Christmas this year?
Well, Christmas, there are two traditions that you probably are aware of. First of all, Christmas Eve is always a seafood dinner. You know, my kids are nice about that. They love the old traditions. And so we do make, believe it or not, the octopus with pasta. You know, make the octopus red sauce. And the little trick of that is that if when you're cooking the octopus in the sauce, if you put a couple of corks in it, it makes the octopus more tender for some magical reason, which is documented as being true, though we don't know why. So we would have lots of wonderful seafood, and then always have the pulpo, which is the octopus with some either, you know, rigatoni or something. And Christmas Eve, you know, my son picked up another Neapolitan thing, which he makes the struffoli. You know what struffoli is?
Aren't they? Don't they look like little chickpeas, but they're sweet? They're a pastry?
Yeah, it's a pastry. You could see the Arabic heritage to southern Italy there. They're like little fried dough balls and shapes and covered with honey and sprinkled with, fruits. What do you call them? Minced fruits.
The candied fruits.
Candied fruits,
yeah,
I mean.
Yeah,
and that's truthfully.
And what will you be drinking?
Well, you know, we have great resources in that area. This Thanksgiving, we drank a new wine, interestingly enough, that hasn't been released yet. It's known as RC Reserve. It's an estate proprietary Syrah blend grown here on the estate, and RC being my son, Roman, who thank God, has in the last 7-8 years developed a real interest in wine. It's clear that he's going to take over the winery in the future, the next generation, and so we're very happy. That's a big issue with a family, prize like this winery. So he is going, we did drink this RC Reserve, which is a Roman's blend, and he worked with the winemaker and created the package. But one of our favorite wines for Christmas is Edizione Pinino, which is named after, of course, my mother's side of the family. Francesco Pinino was her father and a songwriter, and we've commemorated him. And we like the Pinino. It's a Zinfandel, very fruity. And then, of course, we'll have with the Christmas dinner, we'll have Rubicon, which is our proprietary wine.
Have a good holiday.
My pleasure. Merry Christmas.
And to you, too.
Bye.
Francis Ford Coppola produces his wines at the Nibom Coppola Vineyard in the Napa Valley. Well, that's the show for this week, everybody. Thanks for joining us. And remember, you can call us anytime. The number is 800-537-5252. Have a great holiday. You know, it's the time of year we get a chance to take a deep breath, hopefully relax, and reach out to our fellows. Until next week, let me leave you with this thought. Life is like a can of sardines. We're all just looking for the key. Splendid Table is brought to you by SuperTarget. Now, everything you heard here and a lot more can be found on our website, splendidtable.org. And be sure to check out the Splendid Table store while you're there. All the proceeds go to support this very program. Oh, and don't miss out on our free newsletter. It's called Weeknight Kitchen, and we hope it helps make your weeknight cooking a little easier. Register for it online, splendidtable.org. Our producer is Sally Swift with help from Jennifer Russell. Our technical director is Jennifer Lubke. Special thanks to pinch hitter Scott Liebers this week. The piece on Barbara Lynch was produced by John Marston. The Splendid Table is produced by Minnesota Public Radio and distributed nationwide by Public Radio International. Have a wonderful Christmas and join us next time. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
RI, Public Radio International.